on the table, on the shelf in my bathroom, because something about the way the signal bounces around my towers and on my property, the vertically polarized signal out of this repeater arrived in my bathroom horizontally polarized. When I set my handy talkie vertical the normal way, I have to stand in some very specific spot in the bathroom, otherwise I can't hear what people are saying in the morning. Sometimes I'm going to listen in the morning to find out what the traffic is like or what the snow is like on the parkway or whatever. And I have to operate the radio horizontal. So I know what you guys are talking about. So the radio signal goes everywhere, and you can't control that. And so if they've got a leaky cable system that's radiating signal that it shouldn't be radiating, first of all, they're probably violating the FAA rules for a cumulative leakage index, the CLI, and they can pay a pretty heavy fine if they leak enough signal that affects the FAA frequencies, and some of their frequencies used to be on those the same frequencies the FAA uses. A smart cable system nowadays tries to avoid those frequencies to make sure they don't create that problem. But I didn't ask for that signal. It came onto my property. If I keep quiet about it, I know I can use it. And if I'm smart enough with a good lawyer, I think I could win that particular case, because there's no real source of revenue loss there. In other words, if I'm not a cable subscriber, and I'm never going to become a cable subscriber, but now I can get the signal that enters my particular house I didn't ask for, I think I can get away with that one. I know you guys probably think I will not. It's a moot point in that particular. It's a gray zone, without a doubt. Okay, how do we get started on all this? What was the original question? Can somebody bring me up to speed? KQRIW in the TechNet.
KQRIW.
Ready?
A very important comment.
Okay, Eugene, but Eric was first. Eric, go ahead. Yeah, Eric.
Yeah, in the state of New York, there's actually a New York state law that makes it illegal to steal cable in any form, so you'd have a hard time with the argument.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. They've written some very specific rules to make sure that people don't get too enthusiastic on that one. Eugene, what was your question or comment?
Okay, one time, it was very funny. My friend and I, we went to go down to the bay and watch TV. I was at one of those portable TVs that plugs into the car, into the cigarette lighter, and we like to go down to the bay and, play with it, a lot of time. So when we was gone home, we was right by the telephone line. And sure enough, guess what we picked up? No, not an X-ray movie, but we picked up HBO, and we was watching it. We pulled over to the side. We was watching HBO for free for a little while. QSL?
I sure do, and I can see how that can happen. And that can be kind of fun. And I don't think you were breaking any rules doing that. Now, you day after day invite a whole lot of people to come there, and you charge admission for them to watch your television set in that particular location by the bay, guarantee somebody's going to stop you from doing it. Eventually, they're going to call it theft of service. But RF goes everywhere. All you got to do is have a sensitive enough system to pick it up, and it goes everywhere. The right antenna, the right reflector, the right orientation of the antenna, and you'll pick up that signal if it's a sensitive enough receiver system. There's exceptions to this, of course. We all want greater and greater bandwidth. We all would like to have 100 megabit of the rate of the cable, the fiber optic that comes to our house when it comes to our internet connection, so we can download movies in real time and watch them. We'd all like to have that. And sometime in the future, I think it will take place because there's enough demand for that. Bandwidth and signal-to-noise ratio, we're all going to come together with this beautiful, very low-loss transmission medium that you get with fiber optic.
You know, it's all happening now, dude.
Yeah, tell me about that, Eric.
CW. You're absolutely wrong, because back in the 70s, I was playing with MDS, HBO or the other one, where we built the can. We made the 2.5 or whatever those receivers were out of a coffee can. A couple of guys got a visit, and we were told to stop it.
KP2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, Eric first and then Glenn second. You got intimidated, in my opinion, Howie. What you were doing, I think, in the bottom line, was not illegal. Yes, it looked like theft of service, fucked up. And if you were manufacturing those converters and selling them, without a doubt you're breaking laws. But you as an experimenter pick up that signal that you didn't ask for, that was being put into your property, with a good enough lawyer, I think you would win that case. Maybe Eric's going to tell us otherwise. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, actually, there was a company called Microband, and they provided what was MMDS. What they did was they leased channels from something called the IPFS, or the Instructional Fixed Television Service, which is a microwave distribution system that was used mostly by schools, but then it was used by science and satellite system, and actually some of it still exists, but a lot of the people got wise and said, hey, we'll vet this out for money. But what the companies like Microband did is, as they discovered people were coming up with converters, they started scrambling it, and that took care of that. That's about it, Dick.
Yeah, it's one of those rules of countermeasures and counter-countermeasures and so on. Well, lots of people thought for a short period of time they would get the right kind of a card, they would plug it into their direct television, their DSS, the direct satellite service system, and they'd watch all the services free of charge. And of course, the satellite services get smarter and smarter with the encryption techniques, and now it's very, very difficult to do. They've made it...
Actually, it's kind of easy now.
Oh, I've got to talk to you. That's another whole subject. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead.
Yeah, I definitely hear the argument on both sides of this, but something very interesting happened in 1996. Our Congress wrote a beautiful Telecommunications Act in 1996, and a lot of the things that we were able to do prior to that, as far as listening to certain frequencies, cellular telephone frequencies, anything to do with many services, there's some interesting laws in there that you can play in that area. You may want to read that act first, because a lot of things since 1996 have changed.
Yeah, I've heard about the Communication Act of 1996. Give us a couple of words or paragraphs on what do you think, for us as experimenters, were the most significant things that were said there, Glenn, if you happen to remember. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, just really quick, Dick. As far as the amateur service is considered, it affects us in no possible way. The only time that I think that people are going to have difficulties when they go outside of the amateur service and start looking into, let's say, cellular telephones. If you want to build a receiver and start listening on telephone calls, you could find yourself in a problem just receiving, yeah, that signal's within the bounds of your property, but yeah, you can get in trouble there. Other areas, certainly, you know, scooping out signals that are certain key services. If you discovered, you could have a really good lawyer and you're going to bounce right against that 96 Act and it's going to be trouble.
WTTTT. Yeah, Gordon recognized. I know that, I guess it's virtually considered wiretapping when you listen to a cellular telephone conversation, particularly if you reveal to other people what you heard, if you're foolish enough to do that. Having worked on spectrum analyzers and scanners and various things over the years, I know of people who have listened to telephone conversations, and sometimes they've heard some extremely interesting things. But many of the FCC rules on that make that listening and revealing very, very illegal. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, even back in the days of the 34 Act, you know, a lot of stuff was legal to hear but illegal to divulge. The 96 Act was kind of a confluence of perfect storms, if you will. The cable industry didn't want their stuff messed with. The MMDS folks didn't want their, or MDS folks didn't want their stuff messed with. The cellular folks, which were at that point virtually all analog, didn't want their stuff messed with, and the satellite broadcasters, C-band and the fledgling KU stuff, didn't want their stuff messed with. So they basically all got together and, you know, convinced the both the Congress and the President that it would be a great thing to solve the technological gap with law, as opposed to solving the technical problem, which was to encrypt. And of course, as more and more stuff has been encrypted, or digitized, it's become more and more encrypted. Is it easier? I don't know. I'd like to hear the station want to suggest that things are easier now to decode, but I'm not really sure that. I'm not quite confident of that. I think some things are in fact more difficult, but that would be just my opinion. I can learn. So, back to you, Dick. W2TGT.
Fascinating subject. Boy, am I tempted to ask Eric some more questions, but I think I better not. It's an interesting subject there, Eric. I guess I've got to ask you a couple of questions. Where they've made the encryption so difficult, and they think they've got either the code of the day or code of the week, haven't they thwarted most of the effective service people with the current encryption system being used? And if you decide that you think we shouldn't be discussing this, that's your choice, Eric, and I'll certainly understand that. KD2EJ, if you want to. K2RAW on the TechNet.
W2EWK, will comment.
We'll get to you in a minute, Eugene. Go ahead, Eric. Okay, Eugene, you've got your chance. Go ahead.
Okay, when I was a little boy one time, W2EWK, when I was a little boy one time, all the kids in the school, when we were going to school, we had a secret code that we used on the telephone that we can call California anywhere without being paid for. Do you ever hear about that code? Then one time, when I was in school, a man came to my house with a white car and said that code was shut off, and that was the end of it. There was no more code after that.
Yeah, approximately 1969 or so, the so-called blue boxes, as people call them. In other words, the way the telephone system worked in those days is that when you went to a payphone, the payphone issued certain tones which said that you had paid for the call, that you had put the right amount of money in the thing. Or if you read the Bell System Technical Journal from a good technical library, the whole commanding and coding system and whatever was all well described in various issues of the Bell System Technical Journal. So a person with a little bit of smarts building a multi-frequency oscillator could transmit those tones over the earpiece and the mouthpiece, so to speak, of an ordinary handset of a telephone, fool the phone system into thinking that the call had been paid for and it's authorized. And some of these people, what they were doing, I remember a guy who called me up at work once, and I could hear his voice, and it sounded very foggy. What he had done is he had called Australia. From Australia, he had called back to New York. From New York, he had called Australia. In other words, he hooked up these systems back and forth, so making it very difficult to trace. And then he called me, and I'm listening through his voice through, 40,000 miles of communication system. Obviously, Ma Bell had to get a hold of that situation real fast. They made sure that those particular issues of the Bell System Technical Journal were removed from most libraries. They put various changes in the engineering of their system to now make that no longer possible. But those blue boxes were allowing a significant number of telephone experimenters in those days to make a whole lot of calls free of charge with very long distances. I'm not convinced that the total amount of traffic was a high percentage of all of their traffic, but it certainly was getting out of hand. Right now, you've got a very minor version of that problem. The spammers are putting tremendous amounts of spam on the Internet. There were days when I used to get hundreds of spams on a single day because I happen to have a website that supports my consulting business, and a lot of companies that wanted to do advertising were spamming me. I was hoping at the time that the solution would be that each individual message sent over the Internet would be charged one penny. For people like you and I who send 50 messages per week and you have to pay 50 cents for it, it's not a hardship. But for a person who is a spammer sending 10 million messages per day, and he's got to come up with $100,000 per day to pay for it, that's going to be a significant deterrent. Well, my simplistic solution, according to my computer friends, would never work, because for a whole lot of reasons, the internet is advertised as a completely free medium these days, as far as messages being handled once you've established a an internet supplying service. I wonder if people have got opinions on how to avoid the spam problem. I've heard various people say that we should send 1 million pieces of spam to our congressmen so that they fix the problem. Well, what are you expecting your congressman or your senator to do? What is the solution to spam? If you've got a completely free system and you've got people in second and third world countries as an occupation issuing millions of pieces of spam per day and they're being paid to conduct that service, how in the world do you stop it within the definitions of that service? K2LIW, listen, anybody's got an opinion on that one?
Dick, listen to me. Forget about the black box. Forget about the black box. I did it with a touch tone phone to make those
calls.
You do it with a touch tone phone. That's how we used to do it when we was in school. W2EWK, back to net control.
Yeah, I know it could be done with touchstones, with a multi-tone generator. Who was the other person who was transmitting at that time?
W2TTT.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Hey, Dick, the blue box was 7 and 900. Not the same frequencies as touchstone. And then you had in-band signaling of 2,600 cycles.
I agree with that. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, and those were largely resolved, not by removing the publications, but by adding filters. It's not allowing it from the subscriber line side. Anyway, I'm just kind of curious as to how people, I mean, Eric made a, I think it was Eric, made a point that there was, it's easier today to break codes with this thing digital than before. I'm not so sure that's true. I'm just kind of curious. And I know a lot of media content today is protected, not just as to who gets it, but for how long they can use it using DRM, digital rights, management, I think it's called. I'm kind of curious how he feels about cracking that stuff, and is it not reasonably secure? And also the stuff that they use on the set-top boxes in cable and in other similar delivery mechanisms. So how does he feel about the security card reference mechanisms with that?
I'm going to make a guess, Gordon, that everything you do for security is a deterrent, but nothing is perfect. I have a lock on the front door of my house. 99% of the people who might walk through my front door are going to be stopped by that lock. A really serious person with a crowbar is going to easily get through that door, or he's going to break a window and he's going to enter my house. So these things are deterrents, but they're not perfect. When it comes to what the National Security Agency does, they've come up with some very elaborate scrambling techniques, encoding techniques, with very long, non-repeating, irrational numbers, key numbers, and code of the day and whatever. They've got some techniques that are extremely good, and they have to be updated periodically to keep them good. We've all heard the stories of what happened during World War II when it comes to reading coded messages. And the highest classification I ever heard of military hardware is what you knew about the other guy's secret code. And people would die in the process of keeping that particular secret. There were towns in England that got bombed, and you couldn't tell the people to move out of the town because you didn't want to reveal the fact that you had broken the code and you knew that that town was going to be bombed. And you have to choose the most good for the most number of people. And when you make your decisions in tough situations like that, and hopefully you've got Solomonic wisdom when you're doing it. However, every encryption technique, every technique that tries to protect intellectual property is a deterrent, but nothing is perfect, because the day will come when somebody is going to use a supercomputer and he's going to break your particular code that you're using that particular day. And if you're smart enough, you continuously improve the security of the system, you change the code more frequently and so on, and you do various things to make it more and more difficult and you create more and more of a deterrent. But I think we all have to admit, no matter what you do, nothing is perfect. You may think you're real smart. You may think what you've got is a perfect system. I guarantee nothing is perfect. What I just expressed is an opinion. People can express their opinions right now if you'd like to. Give me your call letters. K2LAW on the TechNet. Gordon, I've got a question for you. Gordon is heavily involved with the TechNet that runs on Thursday night, 9 o'clock in New Jersey from the Barra Association, 146.79. I wonder if you guys on your particular TechNet get into crazy subjects like this from time to time, Gordon. What's the hot subject over there at Barra? W2TTT, K2LIW.
Let's see, last week. Well, I think most nets are a mixture of real basic stuff, just how do I go do this? Or what does this mean kind of questions, to more exotic things like, how do you access Echolink? What is an Echolink? And is that IORP or IRLP? I'm sorry, I always get that reversed. Things like that. It's kind of amusing, actually. I would say because we start an hour later and because of the nature of the folks who ask questions on a Thursday night as opposed to a Sunday night an hour earlier, I think you get more hardcore, tactical needs questions, which can raise broader subjects, but in general, the not just the impetus, but also the desired context of or scope of the answer tends to be a bit more concise, even if it goes on for 45 minutes.
Fantastic. I got another crazy question for you, Gordon. When I go to QRZ.com and I type in W2TTT, I found out that right now 4,035 people have looked you up. Are you a big DXer? How come so many people are looking at your particular call letters on QRZ.com? Have you got a guess as to what's going on there, Gordon?
So the truth is I disconnect and reconnect with a new cookie and a new IP address once a minute, and that's how I keep that number up by an automatic query. Now, I have no idea. My guess is, let's see, am I DXer? Yeah, sometimes. Not as much as I'd like, but yeah, the UHF DXer. Not with the level of accomplishment you have in that area, I'll point out. Used to be active in packet radio, but I don't think too many people are looking me up for packet radio information these days because, to put it politely, I think Tapper has ripped out anybody who doesn't have an AMSAT pedigree. That's just my opinion. Let's see, with the exception of Hank Magnuski, of course, that makes sense. They even wrote out Doug Lockhart. Started with the Vancouver board and said Hank built and said I built and then people in Washington built. But anyway, enough of that. So
I don't know.
I really don't know. My guess is probably just a mixture of things over a period of time. I'm curious to know what either the distribution is of that query profile or, how long how long ago it goes back to the 4,000 count. But, over the years I've done a couple of things. I guess, it's been a hammer 30 years, it's real active. You have many blessings you're supposed to give back, so people are going to find a way or a reason to look you up and find out how to QSL you, I guess, or contact you or whatever.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's, by my standards, a very high number. You've got to be a very popular person over there in Bergenfield to have that many people look you up. So it would be interesting to see the profile of number of lookups versus time. Did it occur in a particular month, or is it distributed over all of the years of QRZ's existence. You're 18 years younger than me, and how did the number get that high? I'm, by the way, not a DXer. I'm trying to think of the last time I used a frequency below 30 megacycles. I use it all the time as a tunable IF, but really on the air, it's been some time. I'm a VHF, UHF, EHF person. My favorite band is 10,000 meg, single sideband, but that's not a whole story. And there aren't that many people up there looking me up. So my number is not as big as yours. Yours is bigger than mine. There's a pun there somewhere. Paul, I think we ought to go over to you before we put you to sleep tonight, because I'm not sure whether or not you're going to have to work a full day tomorrow. Paul is our space expert, and NASA's going to be putting up some beautiful pieces of equipment in the future. The space shuttle got scrubbed a couple of weeks ago because the Dawn hydrogen fuel sensors in the tank, there's four of them there, and three of them have to be operating, and I think two of them failed. We've already discussed the fact that they're extremely important. If the hydrogen tank runs out of fuel while the main engine is burning, the three main engines that are producing, let me think now, you get 6.5 million pounds of thrust, 5 million pounds of it is coming from the two solid rocket boosters, so I guess 1.5 to 0.5 million pounds of thrust coming out of each one of those liquid engines, rough rule of thumb if I got the numbers right, so you got 1.5 million pounds of thrust coming out of those engines. Something like a 19-inch diameter piece of tubing is pumping all of that fuel at a zillion gallons per minute from the external tank for those 2 minutes of its use into those engines, and it's all being powered by this super strong turbine. And if that turbine suddenly runs out of fuel and it becomes rat race, as they say, I imagine it goes up to an extremely high RPM, throws shrapnel all over the place, and the lack of the fuel flowing, cooling off the nozzles of the engine, it's going to melt them down. But terrible things happen. I can see why they really care about those fuel level sensors in that tank. And so, too bad that that's such a difficult place to get to in order to do a repair. When you've got some number of million pounds of fuel in that tank, and at the bottom of the tank on the inside of liquid hydrogen running at some ridiculously cold temperature, you've got a fuel level sensor that has failed. To get in there and fix that is really no man's land, if ever there was. But wonder if you've worked out that problem for us, Paul. WS2N, if you're there. K2RIW in the tech net.
Check one more comment, WQWK.
Now, got lights now on the amplifier.
Okay, Eugene, make your comment a little bit brief, but go ahead with your comment, Eugene.
Okay, Dick. All these weeks and months and years, you talk about, your frequencies that you go on, on the dish and that stuff. Could you one of these days give us a demonstration how it works and what it does, and maybe we can meet somewhere? Okay, that's my comment, W2WK Clear.
Clear, thank
you. Yeah, Rich recognized. Now, that's a little more difficult than you think, Eugene. A couple of years ago, the mast on the top of my tower snapped. The 2-foot dish running on 10 gigs came down. I haven't had a chance to put it back up. I've got a number of things I want to change on my tower. So right now, that particular, my main piece of equipment that gives me the most amount of pleasure is not right now operational, and I've got to do something about that. So I'll keep it in mind. I know you'd like to see a demonstration. So when I get it operational again, what I used to do on the TechNet a few years ago is I would transmit from the top of the tower on 10 gigs. I had another receiver in the shack, and I would let you hear what the signal sounded like over the microphone on this 2-meter repeater. I would wave my hand in front of the dish doing the receiving in the shack, and you would hear a burp, burp, burp sound. You were hearing the Doppler shift of the signal reflecting off of my hand as I waved my hand rapidly in front of the dish. I mean, when you're down to a 1-inch wavelength, each time you move your hand or foot, you've gone through 24 wavelengths in and out of your hand of movement. So each time you move your hand, you hear 24 cycles of peak and valley of the signal. So when you're up to those high frequencies, you can do fun experiments like that. I used to demonstrate that to people when it was operational. I guess I promise I'll give you guys another one of those demonstrations when I get the system back up in the air. I've been off now for a long enough period of time. I really miss it. And so I'm getting stronger and stronger feeling that I better put this system back into operation. Rich, go ahead with your question or comment. And speak nice, close to the mic. You don't have to talk loud. We can hear you pretty well. Your mic is pretty good. N2EO, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. I would just like to know if Mel got my mail with a picture of the homebrew kilowatt.
I know I got it, and boy, was I impressed. What a rig. Mel, did you get Rich's email that showed the photograph of his modified Amatron rig? Go ahead.
Yeah, quite a chunk of hardware. Just to give you an idea, you know, that chunk of hardware, what Collins had, thing, but a little bit more involved. But it's quite impressive as it is, Rich, really, as they say, that's a mean amplifier over.
W2PNJ.
Bob recognized, going to get you in a second. That's exactly the conclusion I came to. I looked at that and I said, wow, what that thing can do. Thank goodness he's got willpower. Not to misuse it. Bob, WTPNJ, go right ahead.
Good evening, everyone. Just a brief question. We're doing an interesting job over in the one of the Smithtown schools. It's the middle school. It's 200,000 square foot. We're installing 118 wireless clocks in the school. We installed a small 4-watt transmitter in what they call the penthouse. It's a building that's on the roof of the school above the gym, centrally located. A small hockey puck was installed outside. It looked like a hockey puck. It was an antenna, receiving antenna, which picks up the signal from the satellite. Inside the penthouse, building's all steel, corrugated steel, steel roof, walls. Transmitting antenna is approximately 450 megahertz, vertically polarized, just a small 6-inch stick with a magnetic base. We attached it to the I-beam supporting the roof. The transmitter is only 4 watts. And I just can't believe how well we're installing these clocks. The clocks are running on lithium batteries. Batteries last 5 years, they say. The furthest part from the school, we turn on the battery. The LED comes on within 15 minutes. The clock is installed. 12-inch analog clocks, and they're up in their running speed. Systems made by American Time and Signal in Minnesota. I'm just wondering how amazed how cement block walls, a corrugated steel decking, which has got 4 inches of concrete on it, how the UHF is able to go through all of that. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a beautiful system. First of all, there are watches you can wear on your wrist. There are clocks you can buy for your house that either pick up WWV at 3 o'clock in the morning and align the clock, or the more elaborate ones are picking up direct broadcast, a digital positioning, DPS, digital positioning satellite system. And the really smart hams who are now sending messages back and forth on the microwave reflector of Dr. Tom Williams for the A1 MBA, the Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, has a list serve, he calls it the microwave reflector, where these approximately 250 dyed-in-the-wool microwavers around the world communicate with each other, and they tell each other what they're doing, what they need, and so on. And one of the ongoing experiments for the last couple of years are guys building various systems where they build they get a hold of a satellite, a surplus DPS receiver. Some of these DPS receivers will have an output somewhere on the board which produces exactly one pulse per second, extremely precisely, and they use that with an elaborate piece of electronics to discipline, as they say, their 10-megacycle oscillator that becomes the Shaq reference. And when they properly discipline that oscillator and they use it to control the local oscillators of their receiver system, they can be on the 10 gigahertz ham band or the 47 gigahertz ham band and be the nearest 1 hertz of the frequency they state they're going to be on. If the guy says, I'm going to be on 10.368, which is the calling frequency, and I'm going to be 101.5 kilohertz above that calling frequency, and that's where you and I are going to talk to each other, and we're going to attempt to break the distance record. These guys know how to tune their receiver. They go in the field with this DPS receiving system that's disciplining their oscillators. Even though the temperature on the mountaintop they're on is going up and down, the battery voltage is going up and down, the oscillators can precisely align, the receivers are on the exact right frequency, they carefully aim the dishes at each other, and they sit there and wait for Mother Nature to open the band for them. And the nice thing about the 10 gig band is that you get a band opening a number of times per 24-hour day. Sometime during that day, Mother Nature is supplying just the right kind of atmospheric and homogeneity for that signal going 500 miles beyond your line of sight. That signal finds something to refract off of or reflect off of or diffract off of or deflect off of. That signal gets there by one way or another. And you start breaking distance records as long as you removed one of the main errors people used to have. You used to have to sit there hour on end scanning the receiver up and down, finding the frequency of the other guy. Now they tune their frequency to the right, they tune their receiver to the right frequency, and they sit there, and I transmit on the odd minutes, you transmit on the even minutes, and we wait until Mother Nature opens up the band, and she'll do it if you sit there for a few hours, and you start breaking distance records. So good equipment can remove one of the huge variables that people used to have, what's called probability of intercept. The signal may be, you may have a band opening that lasts for 3 minutes, but you're spending 4 minutes tuning some other frequency and you don't even find the guy and you don't even know it, if you know what I mean. Now, the nice thing about VHF, UHF frequencies is boy, it finds a million ways to get there. How about all the steel you've got of the wire lashing on the concrete of each of the floors and all the steel walls of the building of the World Trade Center? Lots of people would use cell phones and other wireless pieces of equipment inside of that World Trade Center, and it worked like a charm when the building was standing. If I study the way the RF can get around the sheet metal and the wire lashing and the brick walls and everything else of your school building, because you only have to go, I'm going to pick a number, a quarter of a mile or something like that, the longest distance, and you tell me what frequency, 470 megacycles, you tell me a quarter of a mile, the free space loss might be, I'll pick a number, 75 dB. And if you design a system where the transmitter is strong enough and the receiver has got a good enough sensitivity where you can overcome not the 85 dB, the 75 dB, but you can overcome 125 dB, which means you've got another 20, 30, or 40 dB of fade margin, you can now tolerate tremendous insertion losses of the insertion loss of the brick wall and the wire and everything else. Whenever you issue a radio signal, it goes to every cubic inch or every cubic centimeter of this universe, even inside that screen room that you think is well shielded. That signal is there. Inside the screen room, the walls of the screen room are acting as a 110 decibel shield, attenuator. So unless you've designed the system for 120 decibel of power spread capability or fade margin capability, then you're not going to talk to that guy when he's inside that screen room. But I could design a system with a strong enough transmitter on the outside of the screen room and a sensitive enough receiver inside the screen room that even though the screen room is working perfectly, radio-wise, I'm going to talk to that guy inside that screen room. Every shield that you and I can build, Bob, only has a certain number of decibels of shielding. Nothing is perfect. Just like we discussed earlier, that no encryption technique is perfect, no shield is perfect. You give me a strong enough transmitter and a sensitive enough receiver, I'll overcome any kind of shielding you can come up with. In fact, the worst case environment I can think of is inside of the exciter section of the jammer pods that are on some of the Navy aircraft that I've worked on, where the exciter, the low power oscillator, is 2 feet away from an antenna with all kinds of gain that's radiating tremendous amounts of power. In order for the power coming out of the transmitter to not leak through the shielding, get into that low-level oscillator and give you a great big feedback path that goes into its own oscillation, not controlled by your voltage-controlled oscillator. In order to handle that situation, they had to use triple shielding. In other words, you could say they built a screen room inside of a screen room three times in a row to make sure there's enough shielding, to make sure that that transmitter that's only a couple of feet away from that very sensitive exciter section doesn't give them feedback that gives them an undesired response. So every bit of shielding is not perfect, and if you do a good enough design, you can overcome whatever you think is an impediment. It's just a matter of designing enough phase margin into the total system. And it looks to me like that company that you're working with has done that job very nicely, Bob. W2PNJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business. Thank you, Dick. We're thinking of going around the perimeter of the school and selling clocks to the neighbors. Take care.
Yeah, and if they want an accurate clock, they can do it. And believe it or not, that's, as I see it, it's perfectly legal. It's not theft of service, so to speak. They're going to be picking up the signal that wasn't intended to go into their house. They didn't ask for it. And if they got the right receiving system to pick it up to make their clock accurate, more power to them. The fun there somewhere. And with these digital signal processing systems, with these global positioning satellite receiver systems, with these oscillator disciplining systems, you can make a clock or an oscillator as accurate as you can imagine. By way of the global positioning satellite receiver system, I think you can approach the frequency accuracy of the National Bureau of Standards. But that's where it all starts off. The cesium beam standards that are at the National Bureau of Standards is what this whole system is locked to. And what's really amazing, to the best of my knowledge, of all the things that mankind has studied and all the things that mankind has measured, you might ask yourself, what has the most number of digits of accuracy? I mean, the number of digits of accuracy of that 1 meter standard bar that they've got in the Paris Bureau of Standards, is that the most accurate thing in the universe? Maybe not. We measure frequency at the National Bureau of Standards to something like 13 or 14 decimal places. And they're not kidding. 14 decimal places for frequency accuracy. So I think the most accurate thing that mankind measures is frequency or time, whichever you want to call it, whatever frequency is time, of those cesium beam and rubidium beam standards that are used by the NBS. And everything is referenced to that. We used to use the Earth's rotation as the standard. And we suddenly realized that on a high sunspot cycle, when the solar wind is beating down on the Earth's atmosphere and it puffs out the Earth's atmosphere a little bit more than normal, and the moment of the inertia of the Earth very, very slightly increases, very similar to me pouring a cup of water into the ocean and measuring the height of the ocean. Well, the atmosphere gets a little bit fatter, and the Earth slows down, and slows down an amount that can give you something like 1 second of error in a year in the rotation of the Earth. So the cesium beam standards that we're using are many orders of magnitude more accurate than the rate that the Earth rotates. So we no longer use Earth's rotation as the standard for time. That's why the National Bureau of Standards periodically issues these leap seconds in order to make everybody's clocks line up, because high noon, you want it to be the same time everywhere in the world, and the cesium beam clock is an exact time, but the Earth is speeding up and slowing down, so periodically they got to put in leap seconds to make it all come out right. Ain't that a crazy system? Anybody got any specific questions on this before we go over to Paul and find out what's going on in space? KQRIW in the TechNet.
Just a brief comment. W2PNJ.
PNJ recognized. Who was the other person?
KB2LQN. Just a question.
LQN recognized. You're right after Bob. Go ahead, Bob.
First night, my son is running the job. We're working after hours after school. He calls me up and he says, "Dad, go look at your atomic clock. What does it read?" And son of a gun, the digital atomic clock, the seconds, the analog clock for the school are right in sync with my atomic clock on the wall. Okay, thanks again, Dick.
Yeah, I can remember when I first bought an Armatron digital watch, quartz crystal digital watch. I had a gut feel that the thing was capable of extreme accuracy. And so it had a small trimmer capacitor inside when you opened up the back of it. And by listening to WWV day after day, I was adjusting the trimmer capacitor faster and slower in order to make the watch more accurate. I eventually got to the point where the watch was accurate to approximately 1 second, maybe 2 seconds, per month. I was getting that kind of accuracy out of an Armatron watch. My son and I were doing that experiment somewhere around 1980, as I remember, 80, 82, somewhere around there. However, I made a discovery. I wore the watch 24 hours a day. I would sleep with the watch on. Eventually, my wife said, hey, this is kind of crazy, and I would take the watch off and put it on the bureau at night, and I would lose 5 seconds per month, or maybe it was 10 seconds per month. The watch had to be at a constant temperature to get that kind of frequency accuracy. But the modern-day timepieces, wow. We used to think that the, what was the name of that company? I can't think of the name of the watch that the Bulova made. I think it was Bulova. It had a very accurate tuning fork. And it was kind of an electronic watch. Can't think of the name of the thing.
Accutron.
There it is, Accutron. Sure enough, we used to think Accutron, which I think he was claiming 1 second a day accuracy. And nowadays we can get a second a month and a second a year. Well, with a cesium beam clock, we're talking about a second per billion year type accuracy. And I'm not kidding. And the Earth is not accurate enough anymore. We've come a long way. Okay, Walter, KB2LQN, what would you like to ask us or discuss? K2LAW and the TechNet. My name is Dick.
I know, Dick. Thank you much. Earlier, somebody mentioned there was a Seaford AM flea market going on next weekend. I'd like to know where it was, if you remember.
Yeah, that was Bill, WB2CUK. He's the man who on, I think it's every Thursday at around 7:30, runs the swap and shop on this repeater. So this coming Thursday, you can ask him about that. It is the Antique Wireless Association having a small meeting this coming January. And he gave us the details, which unfortunately I didn't write down because it's not my area of interest. I goofed on that one. Bill, are you still on frequency? Okay, but you now, Walter, how to get a hold of Bill, WB2 Charlie Uncle Kilowatt, and as I said, he runs the swap and shop 7:30 Thursday, this coming Thursday. You'll hear him on, and you can ask him at that time, and there's probably other ways you can look that up. Now, I hope Paul is on frequency, WS2N. Are you there, Paul?
I've heard Paul lately, Dick. This is KQKQ. I'm going to ask you another question on the subject, I could say I usually text Paul once in a while on 75. I haven't even heard him lately on there, Dick.
Okay. I see what's happening here. I've got Paul on my list, but I'm looking at the wrong date. Where am I? No. He signed in briefly tonight. Paul did sign in tonight. And I think he even asked us a question. So I guess he's left for now. He'll probably get up early tomorrow. Discuss anything you'd like, Mel. You've got the floor.
Dick, the swap and shop is 8:30 on Thursday night.
Thank you for correcting me, sir. Okay. Hopefully Walter heard that. Mel, you got it.
Okay. Funny, I don't have Paul on my list. Usually write down like you do. I was curious. The time control that they put on the 60 cycle line that Con Edison puts on the line to set, I see now, you've got all the gadgets that, you don't have to set the time anymore, VCR, whatever. What's the accuracy of that over?
It's extremely high. I think it's also related to the National Bureau of Standards. You would think that LOCO is setting their own frequency and trying to do it accurately. LOCO is part of a very massive grid that covers a tremendous percentage of the area of the United States. You are in phase with the power that's being used in Michigan, if you know what I mean. And the thing that's a little bit spooky when you think about it is that Michigan is, 1,000 miles away? And let me think now. 6 microseconds per radar mile, is that it? Yeah. 6 microseconds per mile, 6 milliseconds per 1,000 miles. So Michigan is 6 milliseconds behind us in speed of light time. So if the power grid was working in such a way that the power generators in New York City and on Long Island were producing the majority of the power, and for some other reason that Michigan was low in that power generating capability, so that they were the sink of power, that they were the load and we were the source, they would be 6 milliseconds behind us. 60 cycles is 16 milliseconds per complete cycle. They'd be something like 90 degrees, or you see what I'm getting at here. They could be quite a number of degrees behind us, even though we're all connected to the grid. By the same token, if they were generating the majority of the power and we were the load, we would be 6 milliseconds behind. So you can have a significant difference in the timing across the grid of the United States depending on where the power is being generated and where the power is being used. Now, I use an exaggerated example to get the point across. In reality, you've got a whole lot of individual power stations, a whole lot of individual loads, all distributed on this great big grid. We're all connected together. The good news is that we're all sharing power. We're all connected together. We're all in phase. And I think the master oscillator is at the National Bureau of Standards that keeps it all going right. On top of that, you may or may not know that one of the most accurate things in the world is a 3.579545 megahertz chrominant subcarrier that's used on network-oriented color television transmission. You could, if you're smart enough, wait till your television set is connected to the network, CBS, NBC, ABC, look at that 3.5 megacycle oscillator in your television set that is carefully adjusted to be on exactly the right frequency and exactly the right phase, because if the phase was wrong, Johnny Carson's face, as they used to say, or Jay Leno's face would turn green. So that oscillator has to be extremely accurately set in your television set, because it's locked to that standard. So, and that standard itself is locked to the line, the frame rate at which the color television pictures are flashed onto your screen of your NTSC television. So it's amazing how this is all related to each other, all locked together. And you'll notice that when you get an interference bar across the television screen, it very slowly drifts, because there's not 60 fields per second. There's 59.9 something frames per second, because of the way all these oscillators have to relate to each other. So the joke that we had at AIL one day was a particular Tektronix oscilloscope wasn't working correctly when it comes to the synchronization. A guy was running an experiment. He was trying to make the waveform on the scope sit still. He wasn't skilled on the way he could set the sync controls. And on top of that, that particular oscilloscope was running a little bit flaky. So my buddy, Mario, decided to do a little bit of a joke. He said, okay, I see what the problem is. He gets on the telephone and makes believe he's calling up Long Island Lighting Company. And he said, hey, your frequency is a little bit wrong. Please correct it. Mario, when the guy went and got a Coke, carefully adjusted the controls on the scope so that it synchronized correctly. The guy came back from his Coke. The signal was sitting still on the screen. It wasn't moving. And Mario said, yeah, I told Lilco to correct their frequency. They did, and now your scope is sitting still. And the guy accepted the story. And we all were laughing under our breath and biting our tongues to make sure we wouldn't wouldn't reveal what was going on. It was a great big hoax. He convinced a couple of the technicians in the laboratory that he had convinced Lilco that they were off frequency and how to get on frequency. Of course it's crazy because of this great big grid. The good news is we can share power with that grid. The bad news is when you have that power failure of a shorted out line like you had in Ohio, and it sucked down that system and everybody else got sucked down, and August 14th of 2003, I think it was, a big section of the East Coast of the United States all went dark because of the way the grid went into an instability because of that failure. And I'm of the opinion that those kind of failures are avoidable, because if you disconnect the the right portion of the system at the right time, you can stop that failure from propagating. But you have to anticipate it ahead of time. You have to say, if I have a failure of a generator here, and if I have a failure of a high power transmission line here, but I have to disconnect this, this, and this, and yes, I'll dock in that one community, but that's a hell of a lot better than docking out to one-third of the East Coast of the United States. In my opinion, that's an anticipatable situation that can be planned ahead of time. So the fact that I've seen all these articles published after that blackout saying that the system is a little bit unstable and no one has figured out how to stabilize it, that to me is not an acceptable answer. They're saying that it's complicated and I can't fix it. I don't accept that. Mankind created that system. Mankind can fix that system, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I know about that blackout. I remember it quite well. I was started there in one little power plant somewhere in Ohio, and took out the whole work for one day or so. Before the riot here went on, all kinds of. Oh, I remember coming home that night. What a thing I had here. I didn't know if the power was out until I was on a parkway. And when I got off the parkway, just at the first traffic light, it's out. Caused it. Everybody is complete disarray. It was amazing. I remember from the time I got off the parkway, creeping through each traffic light and all, each intersection carefully and all. It took me about three times the time to get home as usual. So if the accuracy of the clocking on the AC line, why would you want to look into something as exotic as any of these other clocks that you told me, you know, would just be described that there would have been with a transmitter and all to set the clocks and all? Wouldn't it be just as easy to get a clock and plug it into to the outlet there, and would have the batteries in it or anything, and seeing that it's constantly being set correctly, wouldn't that be the, I think, the easiest way to get out of all this with the accuracy of time, Dick, over?
Good guess, but absolutely not. If Loco never had an interruption of power, and if the frequency is being accurately set by the National Bureau of Standards, and if your clock has a synchronous motor synchronized to the 60 cycles, in theory your clock would never gain or lose any time. That's great. What happens when Loco has a blackout on Dover Street in Brooklyn for 1 hour today, and your clock is now 1 hour behind? The only way your clock could catch up is that either they have to put out 61 hertz for a day to lose to gain all those cycles that you've lost during the blackout, or you have to have some other way of setting your clock. So some other way of setting your clock is by way of a radio signal. So the 60 cycle is very accurate if it's never interrupted. But in my particular portion of Huntington, before I put in a UPS system on my computers, we discovered that a roughly 6:30 or 7 o'clock, I think it's around 6:30, in the morning, every single morning in my community, the power drops for about 1.5 or 2 seconds. Enough time that the power supply in our computers goes down and the document you were writing is erased. My wife used to be up at that hour writing documents, and I used to hear her complaining about the fact that the document she wrote just got wiped out. And eventually I got smart enough to put a uninterruptible power supply in that particular computer. So my particular community has a couple of seconds of dropout at roughly 6:30 every morning, and that went on for at least a year that I know about. And my wife complained to Loco, and they said, no, it doesn't happen, no LIPA. They said, no, you must be in error. Our computer did it at that exact time every day. We saw the light flicker and so on. We know it was real. And now, was it happening only on my block, only in my community, or was it my whole section of Long Island? I don't know. I didn't do that much testing. So because of dropouts and no way to restore, there's no way I know of that you could easily send a signal. No way you could easily send a signal through the 60 cycle line to resynchronize all those clocks.